You're listening to the Fusion Patrol Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. Tonight I've got my guest host, Simon, with me. Good evening, Simon.
Good evening. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you, and happy Boxing Day. And we are going to be looking at the 2012 Doctor Who Christmas special, which just aired yesterday in these parts of the world. And it's called The Snowmen by Stephen Moffat. And, well, let's just get right into it. There's a couple things I want to talk about, particularly about the 50th anniversary nature feel of this episode. But let's just chat about the episode. How did this work as a Christmas special for you, Simon?
As a Christmas special, I think it was as an episode, I thought it was a very solid episode. I did find myself enjoying it a great deal. And as a Christmas episode, I thought that it had all the kind of right elements to feel like a Christmas episode. It didn't feel like necessarily it was an all-out in the way that A Christmas Carol, which I still particularly love, felt like it was almost a step out from the kind of regular series. It didn't feel like a special in that sense. It felt like it fitted in, particularly because of the importance of Clara or Oswald in the story. I hugely enjoyed it. I thought the Christmas elements, snowmen and everything, were nice touches and well done.
I thought this was interesting because, as you say, it was more of it felt like more of a non-Christmas episode that just happened to be set in the winter in Christmas. For that reason, I like this one better than most, if not all, of the previous Christmas specials, simply because it was very Doctor Who-ish. I had some things I didn't like about it, but it was very good from the standpoint of not being too silly for Christmas, but it was there, and it had a good feel for the Christmas time to it. So I was pleasantly surprised by the episode with, like I say, with just a couple of minor reservations, most notably the brooding Doctor motif again, which is not one of my favorites.
I'm sympathetic to that. I mean, I'm not particularly fond of the brooding Doctor myself. I have to say that I thought that this episode handled that particularly well, given that we were going to have this notion of the Doctor sucking in a box, as Clara puts it, that we had that expressed rather than the Doctor moping around and being particularly self-pitying. We had that expressed through the kind of reservations and actions of his friends, which I did think was a particular strength in this episode, the way that Madame Bastra and Jenny and Strax were almost protecting him, and that they worked. I mean, I loved all the lines. I'm totally enjoying the comedy Sontaran thing, and Dan Starkey as Strax is just so funny and so good, and Moffat keeps feeding him the best lines. So to me, that was a particular highlight of the story, and obviously that was connected with the brooding Doctor notion, but it didn't feel like that was allowed to come in and dominate, particularly after the way that had been built up so strongly.
I liked Strax quite a lot in the episode, and I don't particularly go with the comedy, the slapstick comedy kind of stuff, but I thought that they, whereas it might have been a little bit silly, they at least picked a good character to do this to, because we have the genetic inbreeding concoding, I should say, of violence and war and aggression, and then they've got his better nature, the two of them playing against each other. And that's just a really good fit for comedy. And so it doesn't bother me as much when you see this Sontaran, jumping with his first conclusion, and then at the same time you can obviously see he cares for the Doctor and he's trying to help, but you know, his nature is fake. So I like the character. I wish we'd gotten a little bit more about which friend it was who brought him back to life. That was an interesting comment, and are we going to find out about that later on?
A friend who brought who back Strax. To life? Did I miss something here?
The doctor said he was dead. He helped me out and he died. And then they said, well, how's he alive then? And he said, another friend brought him back to life.
Oh, okay. Well, I've only got various technological difficulties have meant that I've only got to see this episode quite briefly once, and so there may be certain things that pass me by. So that was very interesting.
Yeah. So this is post.
I missed it altogether.
Demon's Run, Strax. So he did die there, and I don't know how that. You know, I guess they don't want to do the river thing with meeting them up with different sections of time. So this has to be, this is a linear meeting after Demon's Run. Lady Vastra and Jenny, I'm less enamored with, just because they don't really do a whole heck of a lot. We haven't seen a lot of why I should care about the veiled detective. And I kind of thought the scene where you had to answer everything in one word was pretty unfeasible in the grand scheme of things. I don't know what its purpose was.
Oh, I did like that. I mean, I did think this was in the last sort of mini season of five episodes. I did think that I was impressed by Asylum of the Daleks, and I didn't particularly think that. The Angels Take Manhattan was Moffat playing to his strengths. This story struck me as Moffat really finding his writing mojo. And this particular scene with the one word thing did seem to me that he was. I mean, it was maybe a bit indulgent, but it was clever and well done. And the only thing that didn't quite work for me was the kind of crowbarring in of the pond. Thing as the one word at the end, but generally I thought that scene worked, and I thought it showed up Moffat's cleverness, and there were elements in this episode where I kind of thought they're breaking the fourth wall again and they're doing it deliberately because they're being a bit too clever. This I thought was clever but not too clever, if that makes sense.
The one word pond was again, is that the only way that works is through wild coincidence. It's coincidence that the ice lady is being formed in the pond, and pond happens to be the name of the companion that he's sulking about, which Oswin, well, actually kind of, you know, maybe might have some sort of key into if all these various Oswins are connected somehow. But I thought, well, that's just... You know, this relies on the wildest stroke of coincidence, and it relies on the wildest stroke of coincidence because of the conceit of writing the scene where you have to make all your answers in one word. And, you know, if they had said, you know, you have to make all your answers in five words, you know, why one, why not five, why not ten, why not... I know that they're trying to show someone distilling things down to its essence, essential essence, is that a correct term? But... It was just a little bit much, particularly with Pond at the end. So that kind of turned the scene for me. Well, let's just go over the basis of the plot without giving away too many spoilers. The Doctor is sulking away in Victorian London, and he's called it quits. He doesn't want to help the universe anymore. He's tired. He's actually got his TARDIS positioned up literally in the clouds behind a spiral staircase, and he just does nothing. And Lady Vastra, Jenny, and Strax, under the guise of the veiled detective and her fatuous assistant, which I thought was a very, very appropriate description of Jenny, and their manservant Strax, the Sontaran butler, travel around London solving crimes without so much as anyone screaming in terror, apparently, that Lady Vastra is a lizard and that Strax is obviously not a human being. That part, well, I'll take a moment here and just ask you about that. Does that seem viable to you?
Yeah, I'm fine with that. I mean, I think the veil hides the fact that she's a Silurian or whatever, and that Strax is the coachman in the shadows or whatever can get away with it. So, yeah, I was fine with that. I have to say, again, maybe one indulgence too much was the suggestion that this duo were the inspiration to Conan Doyle for the Sherlock Holmes stories, though obviously Moffat was keen to bring Holmes into the Sherlock, into the Doctor Who world. I mean, I think this has come up before. I may be wrong, but because I haven't read many of the Doctor Who novels from the period when it wasn't on the television, but I think that it was posited there that there is an overlap between the fictional world of Sherlock Holmes and the world of Doctor Who. And here it was kind of making it clear that no, Doctor Who and the world of Conan Doyle, the world in which Sherlock is a fiction, are one and the same.
I was just going to say that until you mentioned it, it never occurred to me that I forgot completely that Moffat works on Sherlock, and that there's also a joke, a gag there, if you will, about Sherlock, and how I just didn't put the two together, because just Victorian London and Sherlock Holmes is the man of the day in those days, and I just didn't get it. How weird.
Oh, no, instantly, and particularly the scene in which the Doctor Who goes and announces himself as Sherlock Holmes, and that particular performance made me think, oh, Benedict Cumberbatch must be getting a bit worried there.
I don't think Matt Smith is going to be taking over for Sherlock anytime soon.
I thought he did a terrific job at it. He was brilliant.
He was doing a pretty good Matt Smith job of pretending to be a bumbling idiot playing Sherlock Holmes, but I didn't see that as a particularly... It wasn't meant to be a credible depiction of Sherlock Holmes. I mean, I thought that was the whole point. But, he looked good in the Deerstalker and all. I thought that was... a nice touch. Anyway, so there are these... funny thing is, this is a story is more about Oswin than it is a story about the villains of the piece, I felt like. It's really kind of the story of Clara, I should call her, chasing the Doctor. She encounters the Doctor and, frankly, is overly obsessed with him too quickly, I think. I mean, I don't think that their first encounter was sufficiently engaging or encouraging that would make her go and chase after him. And so we either have, well, another conceit that says, well, because Lady Vastra says at one point to the Doctor, it's like, oh, well, you're having that effect on someone again. It's like, I've barely ever seen that effect on a companion before. And now we have Clara, literally hiking up her skirts and chasing the Doctor through the streets to catch his cab. And it just doesn't... obviously, the other alternative is that there's something embedded in Clara's brain or whatever it is that's drawing her to the Doctor, which I guess we will see later on, maybe. Not with Clara, though.
I took the reference for saying that the Doctor has this effect on people, that previously he has kind of inspired a certain... even some of the standalone adventures or whatever, there has to be a reason why... at the end of The Runaway Bride, for example, where Donna doesn't go with the Doctor, and that, there kind of has to be a reason for this, because... obviously, an adventure with the Doctor is an incredible experience. Now, I take your point in this one that Clara hasn't had an adventure with the Doctor. She's had a two-minute conversation with him about a snowman. So I think that's a fair point. But I'm not sure what we... It didn't bother me too much, partly just because I guess we have this idea of the Doctor being this incredible... intriguing, charismatic individual, and you kind of think even a few moments conversation would perhaps convey some of that, but also maybe not just to anyone, but also because Clara is somewhat unfathomable, unpredictable. It's not clear, and obviously there's a whole mystery around the Oswald character, but it's not clear why she is pretending to be a barmaid and or being a barmaid and then pretending to be a governess, or being a governess and then pretending to be a barmaid. There's something about what she chooses to do that's quite impulsive, that isn't clear to an audience what it is that makes her tick.
Yeah, and they didn't give that answer at the end. Basically, the doctor.
I think that's something that is that's part of the sort of story of season seven that's still to come.
Yes, and I don't disagree that we know that's coming. But somebody sitting down and watching the Christmas special standalone, would that be as obvious? I mean, I know they ended it off showing Clara's whatever in the future. Standing at the grave of Clara the dead. But, you know, it did seem kind of like, just in the same way that Oswin in Asylum of the Daleks came to an end, Clara also comes to an end. And I just feel like that there's some, we'll call it an essence, that I think the Doctor is chasing this essence that's running through people, but that's, you know, a guess. And so he's trying to find it in another guise in the future. But would that drive, yeah, the governess and the barmaid thing just totally make no sense. There's just no point. It's unless Clara knows that she needs to be the governess in that house so that she can meet the Doctor. So that this is some predestined thing, which, you know, kind of fits with that whole bumping into him and then suddenly chasing after him. It's as if she's been guided towards him, but it's still kind of, why pretend to be a barmaid? Why not just become a governess? You know, I don't know. A little confused.
Yeah, because I mean, it may be that this isn't explained, but I suspect that this is the second time we're seeing her, obviously, and we've already seen one character, one personality that is her and is not her, and so to seeing her the second time, it maybe makes sense that she's not simply one personality, there are two personalities in effect there, even though she is consciously playing both of them, it adds to the layers and the complexities of her character. I find the whole Oswald thing quite exciting, and I'm getting that feeling again that I got from watching Asylum of the Daleks that you know, that makes me want to watch, makes me quite excited for the year of Doctor Who ahead, because there's a real juicy mystery to get our teeth into here, and I'm looking forward to seeing how it plays out.
Okay, so here's a question for you about Oswin then. In Asylum of the Daleks, she has, and I didn't see it, but, you know, in retrospect, when you're watching the episode and you know what's going to happen, you realize that she's kind of kitted out like a Dalek in her, you know, like the egg beater is the stalks on the Dalek and everything, so that she's carrying it. So, and there's sort of like a slightly layered Dalek look to her once you realize that that's kind of what they're trying to do, which we assume that she's taking in her mind, she's projecting a self-image, and that self-image is somehow slightly mixed with the Dalek. And I got, at least that's how I took it. And so the whole thing about the souffle is a justification for the egg beater that she's always carrying with her. But, and so I attributed that to trying to work the Dalek out into her faux reality. But now she's talking about souffles in Clara guise. So is there, am I totally wrong about the whole egg beater idea and the Dalek motif? Or are we saying that it's not just that they're sort of, in other words, if there were a let's say there's a soul, we'll use that term, just that's passing through these people. Obviously, in strict linear time, Oswin hasn't happened yet. But in nonlinear time, it has. So do you see what I'm getting at? Because it's kind of a difficult one for me to put into words. But
yeah,
Is Dalek Oswin there in this person?
My interpretation was there was some kind of bleed through. So I suppose, yes, because there isn't an obvious linear sequence to whether Oswin or Clara is first. They are two manifestations, perhaps, of I don't know the answer, but I don't know. It could be separate, but I don't think you're wrong to make that association between the Dalek and the the Oswin character from Asylum, but equally, if that is there in the Oswin version, perhaps that's something that then is there in all the versions, and it could still be because of that Dalek association. I don't know. I mean, it's just another of these things I'm looking forward to finding out.
Yeah. It's a. I don't mind a mystery. You know, I don't mind a season-wide mystery, provided that we don't get a cheat at the very end of it. I've already seen somewhere that Moffat did not have a plan. From his own words, he didn't have a way of tying the two characters together when he wrote Oswin. So, you know, that's always a bad sign, in my opinion, when you've already got your outcome, but you haven't figured out why the outcome is there. But I'm willing to take it. It's an interesting mystery. So let's see, where were we summarizing? So the Doctor, and he meets Clara, and she chases him and wants to meet him. Meanwhile, there's actually bad guy stuff going on. Richard Grant. It's Richard Grant, right? Is the actor?
It is. The E is presumably an equity requirement.
Because there's another Richard Grant. Yeah. And he is the bad guy. He's grown up in the company of this creepy snowman, we find, and he's working at a plan for bringing some creature to Earth to devour the humans for some disturbed reason. How'd that threat work for you? I was kind of a little nonplussed by that part of it.
The threat, in theory, was fine. I mean, I liked the snowmen. I thought the snowmen worked well, and I liked the kind of the setup, the sort of possessing the small child, you know, loner, and building on that. I did think that it lost something because there was this big build-up to the governess in the ice, and what is she and what does she look like. I did think that the way that was realised was one of the slightly weaker elements of the episode. The way she moved was very... It didn't... You know, a snowman that looks like a snowman but has sharp teeth, there's something real and menacing about that. A kind of mad ice lady is just a mad ice lady.
Yeah, I liked the snowmen were fine. I thought that was a good touch, and we can discuss what your memories or at hand knowledge of the Abominable Snowman and Web of Fear are as we go along here on this. But the ice lady, yeah, that kind of let me down. I mean, what's growing in there? Why did it have to be growing in that pond? Why, you know, why if they needed DNA? I mean, they ate enough people there in the courtyard, the workers collecting the snow. I mean, it's not like they didn't have ready access to lots of people. I just didn't. And then so we need a little chunk of that so that we can send it off and make more ice people that will be easily defeated. That was just more of an excuse to run around and have Strax doing fun things and whatnot.
Yeah.
So is it the great intelligence from Abominable Snowman and Web of Fear, do you think?
You know, despite the snowman, that hadn't even occurred to me. I haven't heard the whole of the Web of Fear. I've only seen the surviving episode, and that was some time ago. So I'm going to have to go back and listen and watch to the episodes of that to work out the answer to that.
I haven't listened or watched the episodes on that, but I have the books, which I've probably read in about 1984 or 5. So, it's been a very, very long time since I've read them. And, I seem to recall that the Great Intelligence was an actual intelligence, not a mirroring kind of thing. And if I recall correctly, the Web of Fear occurs in about 67, and it's a contemporary story, or at least it's a contemporary unit story. So you know, is that 1967 plus however many years UNIT is in the future, or is that 1967? I'm not sure. And then the Abominable Snowman was, if I recall correctly, 50 years earlier, or 40 or 50 years earlier in Tibet, which would have put it 1917. So this is an earlier great, and if it's the great intelligence, then this is an earlier great intelligence. And so my, you know, throughout the episode, what we're presented with is first, it seems like it is an intelligence. Then we get to the point where the doctor basically says, no, it's not an intelligence. It's really just a reflection of this guy's disturbed mind. And then after he eliminates his mind, then the intelligence takes on true sentience. So I'm wondering if this is the birth of the great intelligence from those episodes. From, you know, it's not a time traveler, so it's got to be linear in that respect.
It makes sense.
And there was something about that tin that the doctor was holding.
Oh, the tin with the underground.
Yes.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. You're totally, definitely right.
But where...
I'm really slow.
I put it
down to an overdose on Christmas pudding.
Oh, it's the pudding, is it?
It's pudding, yes.
It's the pudding, of course. I just thought that there was something that the doctor said or somebody said at the end of the episode about why would they think the 1967 underground was a weakness or something like that, or was a vulnerable weakness or something of that nature. And I'm like, well, now the whole thing to me was predicated on the great intelligence being born right there. And so it wouldn't know anything about its attack in 1967 or even know about 1967 subways. So that didn't make any sense to me. And then to carry that a step further, if the doctor was talking about the subway and that's what gave the people the idea about it being a weakness, then why is he completely ignoring Tibet and a more, you know, it just seemed like a kind of very, it just didn't seem very well connected if it was the great intelligence. But I mean, despite the fact that it says great intelligence all over the place, we even know now that they at one point, you know, this GI is all over the house and the signs and the business cards, and it's all over the place, and it's the Great Intelligence Institute or something like that. And they had posted a picture on the BBC website of the doctor sitting in a room that had that GI on the window, and they pulled it. The BBC pulled it almost immediately. And so clearly that was what they were trying to keep a secret. It just didn't seem like such a great surprise to me that this is the great... I don't know.
It's a great surprise to me because I obviously didn't cotton on to any of this. But now you mention it, particularly with giving them the underground map, that seems a very strong connection. Brilliant.
So maybe we'll get to see proper Yeti sometime one of these days. But, and so then the tie-in between the Abominable Snowman and the Snowman, I thought that was a clever way to try to do it. But I must admit, I'd like to see the Yeti come back instead of animated Snowman. Let's see. What else is there? I mean,
I was going to say one thing about the whole bad guy thing was that I think you're absolutely right. The story was about Clara Oswald, and I thought her performance and Matt Smith in this, their performances were both fantastic. I don't have any criticisms of Richard E. Grant, but he is a great actor. He's done some fantastic films, and I suppose I was a little bit underwhelmed by the role he was given and the role he played in this. It just didn't seem as menacing as I felt, you know, he could do. And, you know, similarly, the voice of Ian McKellen, you can't go wrong, but it did the job and it was fine, but it perhaps wasn't everything it could have been.
Yeah, Grant's character, Dr. Simeon. Simeon, was it?
Yes.
That's a weird name. I wonder if there's something in that we haven't caught, but... Anyway, he was there, And probably I could picture Stephen Fry playing the part just as well. You know, it's kind of that faux Victorian, stringent, whatever called, kind of offset kind of person. There was an interesting line in it, though. The doctor at one point is berating Victorian values. And I thought that, you know, that's fine. But I thought it was a nice touch that a Victorian person would respond with, "What's wrong with them?" Because, of course, they would. You know, I mean, that's you don't set up your culture's values for your time and place and think they're bad. You obviously think they're correct. And a lot of times, particularly British programs, I see. I think you do see kind of a bit of Victorian bashing. Frankly, I can understand why. There's some interesting things that came out of that period, but you know, there were some quite bad things that came out of that period too. But you can only judge it from history, and no one living at that time could judge themselves correctly. So I thought that was almost an apology for them, but not quite. But I liked it. I appreciated it that somebody saw that.
I think it makes sense, their motivation, without having to kind of be into cultural relativism. You can still say that from the point of view of someone living in that era, as you say, their values are their values, and they're not going to choose them and live by them and not believe they're right.
So would that line have worked if the doctor had been in 2012 and said, typical early 21st century values?
I think he does sometimes. I mean, I can't think of any particular examples for the moment, but I think you do get the sense, and I think it, in present-day stories, it's done more to emphasise the fact that he is an outsider. And maybe it's not done so much as a, you know, typical 21st century, you know, British or Western
explicit
values.
Right.
But it's you know, the human race.
Typical human race, yes.
Yeah.
That is, you know, slightly different from pinning it down to the place where he is standing at that time and saying, you know, these are
sure
wrong.
And that's more difficult because obviously it's a TV series that is being made in 2012. And so you have to bear in mind that the audience is watching it from that perspective.
So what else you got on this story?
Well, I don't think I've got anything else on the story per se, but there are a couple of changes that we might want to comment on.
Ah, yes. Okay, well, I'll before we go to the change, I think I know which change you're talking about in particular, but I will say, if I haven't in this episode, that I really liked Clara.
Seconded.
I thought, for starters, she's very pretty. Those great big
eyes.
Yeah, those great big eyes are really striking on her. And she's, I haven't been annoyed by her in the way that I expected to be annoyed by her, based on the things that Moffat and Matt Smith have said about her, you know, being a mile a minute, and she's really a match for Matt. Because, as you know, I don't really particularly like the manic doctor mode. And so I don't think, just, you know, if you put it in front of me and say, do you think a manic companion and a manic doctor would be a good combination? My answer would be, no. I do not think so. But it so far seems to work. Clara seems smart, very smart, and different. And I think that was the line about the TARDIS being smaller on the outside, instead of saying bigger on the inside, is to show us that she's a little bit askew, perhaps, from the run-of-the-mill companion. But anyway,
she's not just a new companion, which I think is a difficult enough role to fill at this point when you've had the same companion team for 2.5 years, which in Doctor Who terms is quite a long time. But also, clearly, you know, what's emerging out of this story, following on from what we had before, is that she is the arc. She's going to be the story. So, you know, she's not just going to be an interesting companion. She's more than just an interesting companion. And I would totally agree. I think so far she's been wonderful.
Yeah. Okay, so the changes. Are we talking about the opening credits and the music?
Well, there is that, yes. What did you think?
I cheered when the face appeared on Twitter, in the credits, I saw at that time references on Twitter firing up about the face. Finally, they got the face back
now,
on
the credits.
Is that
a 50th anniversary thing, do you think?
I think so, because one of the I didn't catch it at the time. Okay, well, all right, let's take a step.
I'll come clean, and I will say I didn't see it. When I watched the episode, I didn't see the face.
You didn't see the face? It's very faint.
I missed it altogether. It was,
You watched it on iPlayer, right?
I watched it on iPlayer. Possibly, certainly wasn't the highest quality.
And a dodgy connection.
The speed of my internet connection. Dodgy connection. But also, you know, I was listening to the music and I was a bit sort of disorientated by the sudden sort of camera swings and everything.
And the pudding.
And I haven't had a chance to go on Twitter to see what people are saying. So I wouldn't... the pudding, of course. Yes, thank you for filling in all of my other excuses. But I just have to go back because obviously it's a new title sequence. I wanted to watch it again. And the face just leapt out at me the second time. It felt suddenly so obvious. Once you've seen it, you kind of think, how could you miss that? But I don't know. I got a real McCoy vibe off it for some reason. I think it's to do with the fact that you see space through the vortex.
Here's
it's
the
not
thing.
Just the vortex.
So I saw... I don't know whether you managed to avoid the spoiler or not. I certainly didn't treat it as enough of a spoiler to try to hide it from my contacts. So, I mean, the first picture, the second picture of the new TARDIS interior, is the other one, when I saw it beforehand, made my heart leap for joy because it looks like the TARDIS, finally, after all of the new era Doctor Who, I have never cared for the organic orangey TARDIS. I didn't like the TARDIS in the Eccleston Tennant era at all. I just thought that was just a ridiculous change compared to what we know
okay,
TARDIS well, looks like. Go ahead.
I know we've got a sort of full episode regeneration special on McGann, but what about the TARDIS in there? Because you can't skip over that one.
I can say that I thought the McGann TARDIS was more consistent with the Tom Baker Brown TARDIS. So I could accept that as a secondary control room kind of thing, as a movie version of that. You know, the set that Tom Baker had for the secondary control room was incredibly small. And that was really my complaint about that set, was that it was incredibly... I can kind of accept it. I thought that's what they were going for in the McGann movie. But when they went with the Eccleston TARDIS, you know, that's a completely different technology look to it. It looks grown. It looks like it's made, I think they call it coral at times. I just don't care for that look. And I don't like the explanation of it's just a different desktop. That's just silly. And I just don't care for that look. I think it looks more like a Zygon ship, frankly, which is supposed to be grown and organic. And the console should then be dripping in molasses and syrup and excretions from the plants it's made out of or whatever. I just didn't care for that. And when Matt Smith's TARDIS is his early one, it was a huge improvement, but nonetheless, I still didn't quite like the color scheme. And I definitely do not like the, the old typewriter and the cobbled together bits. I know the idea is that he's been fixing it for centuries, but I just, you know, and then I could kind of take that in the Eccleston TARDIS, that he's been strapping stuff onto the TARDIS for ages to get it to work. But when the TARDIS itself regenerates and incorporates an old typewriter and I think the fluid reservoir from a windshield wiper on a car at one point and just bits of random junk, I just don't like it. And I love this new TARDIS. I think it looks a little flashy with the double twirly thing up top, but by and large, I really think it looks like a Doctor Who TARDIS. And when I heard that there was going to be a new opening credit sequence, I thought, you know, I'm going to put my trust back in Mr. Moffat here for a little bit, because I know he's a classic series fan of long standing. And I thought, you know, I'm thinking they're going to push it back towards original Doctor Who credits and original Doctor Who TARDIS. and whether that's for a 50th anniversary thing or whether that's just his natural progression towards the way he wants to steer Doctor Who. But either way, I was looking forward to something more old school for the credits. And a couple people said, you know, when you hear see the credits, you're gonna classic Who fans are gonna be really happy. And I knew that either meant the face or the proper time vortex, some variation of the Pertwee Baker time vortex, and it turned out it was both, kind of, and more.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't share necessarily your observations about the previous new series TARDIS. Well, actually, I quite liked the Eccleston TARDIS. I particularly liked it. I didn't think it was as good when it regenerated for Matt Smith's first one. I wasn't that overwhelmed by the photos that I saw of this, but in the episode, I thought this TARDIS did look fantastic. You know, the best new series TARDIS look. And I particularly like the fact that it's changed and, you know, because Matt Smith's been living in Victorian London and all the rest of it, it didn't need any explanation. You know, there's no need to refer to it. It's just, we've got a new TARDIS in here. That's fine. Fantastic.
You know, it happened many times.
And
oh, go ahead.
I agree that I do think the direction of travel has been kind of back towards not necessarily taking things back, but certainly putting in references and styles from the classic era. So you have got that in the title sequence with the face, which I think has got to be a nod and can't be a coincidence that's happening this year. But also the costume, costume. I never liked the tweed jacket with the leather patch and all the rest of it. I thought that when they took the original party shots of Matt Smith just wearing a T-shirt and a jacket, he looked terrific. And when they kind of put them into this sort of Professor Brainstorm outfit, I thought it just looked daft, and I kind of came to live with it. But having seen him in something a bit better, I just think, oh yeah, fantastic.
I'm guessing he'll be back.
It works on Matt Smith, but also it's a kind of nice nod to the sort of Hartnell and McGann costume. So I'm very happy with these changes.
Yeah. Speaking of the credits, after the fact, then, and I will tell you that I also watched it on iPlayer on a dodgy connection. So the opening credits, as you know, anytime you're watching something streaming over the internet, anytime the motion picks up, the quality of the picture degrades. And so the opening credits I have yet to see in beautiful HD. So it's hard for me to tell, but afterwards I read a few people online talking about the fact that it has several nods to the classic series in it, including the Sylvester McCoy space-time bubble is in there. And
yeah, I got a lot of McCoy off it.
And, you know, a new variation of the Pertwee Baker time vortex there at the end, kind of, which is, you know, not much different. They've had that all along, so I'm not too thing. And the face, which every time I've watched it does appear relatively subtle. I mean, it's certainly much subtler than, say, Sylvester McCoy's face popping up and winking at you. It's not that bad. But, you know, it was great to see it back again. I'm very pleased. I'm very pleased. The new music, I don't know. I'm going to have to listen to that. I didn't dislike it, but it seemed very similar to Matt Smith's previous version with just some, I don't know, slightly different instrumentation that was a little more electronic. Maybe that was what it was going for. Classic.
I got a kind of McGann movie vibes, you know, the John Debney version of the theme. I got something like that off the change, the music, and actually the visuals on those new opening credits. What surprised me was that it seemed to have changed music at the end. Is that still the original 11th Doctor version at the end? Because it doesn't sound like the beginning credits.
I did not notice it at the end. Like I said, I listened to the opening credits and I said I knew they were going to be different, but it started out exactly the same, and then it kind of changed the instrumentation a little bit, and I thought, well, that's not a huge That's not a huge chain. Yeah, all right, fine. And then the end credits, I listened to it, and I just was kind of like in that mode and said, well, it's, you know, not that much different from the old one. But I have listened to the new one a couple of times since then, and the opening credits, but not the ending credits. And I can hear different. I mean, Ben is going to freak out because Ben's like Mondo. He can like listen to music and then turn around and play it on a piano. It's a freakish talent that he has. I'm very impressed with it, but I haven't got that. And so he will freak out and go, no, that's totally different music. I'm sure he will. But it is different. I'm not trying to underplay that, but it's a different version of the Matt Smith version is what I'm getting at, if that makes any sense. It's not like the difference between the Baker version and the Peter Davison version kind of difference. It's much closer. I heard a little bit of the Trial of a Time Lord version in there too. There's a little something to it that reminded me of the Trial of a Time Lord version, so, which is my favorite version of the theme. Well, it's about the best thing about the Trial of a Time. I liked that version. I liked the version with the sort of scary noises going on in the background, as opposed to the very clinical Davison era.
Oh no, you can't malign the classic Howl version.
I can. I don't dislike it. I just think it's
well,
very.
Obviously you can. You just have.
I did. Well, it's obviously it's just sort of. You know, it was new and it was different. And it was exciting when it changed over. But in retrospect, sometimes you listen to people doing electronic music and you have very generic. And then you have somebody who's like Tangerine Dream or something who really somehow put some sort of inspiration into it. And I kind of think the Peter Howell version's a little in the former category there. Not bad, not in any way bad, but you know, there's inspiration in the original version because it's so different. It's so unearthly. Maybe that's what I'm getting at. The original version you don't hear any other songs sound like that, right? I mean,
no,
nothing
the,
else
the
is
the original version is incredible.
And then the Peter Howell version, it's the same instrumentation that a lot of shows at that time used, and that's all. Maybe that's what I'm getting at. It's just not as inspired. How about that? Anyhow, gosh, we totally passed that on our regeneration specials.
I'm not going to agree, but I think maybe we're getting off topic, perhaps, or I'd be going on about the Series 4 Murray Gold theme and why I like that, but perhaps we'll leave that for another time, and we'll get Ben to tell us exactly what differences have been introduced since the closing credits of the Snowmen.
Oh, and I should say that Ben has, if you go out to the Fusion Patrol forums at fusionpatrol.com, Ben has posted his review. He wasn't able, he has to work on Boxing Day, which is terribly sad, because I'd like to have had him in here with us, but he has posted his review of this episode on the forums, which I haven't read, not because I'm not interested in it, but because I didn't want to. I didn't want to take his points or step on his points or however the case may be. So if you're interested, do go to fusionpatrol.com.
Likewise. Yeah, I'll be going in there. And I didn't want to read it before for the same reason, but I'll be going in there and responding to what he says.
And so let's see, anything else? So we got the TARDIS, we had the music, we had the opening credits. All in all, I'm looking forward to it, the new series, or the new half series, or the latter half of the series, however we want to look at that. I think it's...
Yeah, and hopefully some more for the 50th anniversary, too.
Well, then, in that case, I'm going to declare this special Christmas episode of Fusion Patrol to be pretty much closed. I will make a couple of minor announcements here that I think, if I look at my numbers correctly, this is about the 93rd episode of Fusion Patrol. So we're coming up on our 100th episode of Fusion Patrol, and we are going to do something special. I don't know what that's going to be, but because that's like weeks away. But we're going to do something special for our 100th episode, and it doesn't seem like 100 episodes. Maybe if you're a listener, it probably seems like 1,000 episodes. But It just doesn't seem like we've done that many. I should go back and listen to some of the old ones and see if they're as bad as I suspect that they are. Heck, I could just go listen to the last week's and find out if they're as bad as I think they are, I suppose. Keep an eye out for that. Ben will be back in our next episode where we are going to be reviewing – we've actually already done it. I just haven't published it yet. We're going to be reviewing something. I don't actually remember what we did. Oh, yes, it was UFO, episode close-up. That will be next. And then Simon and I will be back at some point here in the new year to talk about Twin Dilemma. I'm looking forward to that one almost as much as I'm looking forward to Time and the Ronnie. Anyway, thank you for joining me, Simon.
A pleasure, as always.
And go back to your Christmas pudding.
I don't have to hold back anymore.
Yeah, there you go. And we hope you'll join us all again next time. And happy holidays to you all. Here from Fusion Patrol.
You've been listening to the Fusion Patrol podcast, a production of Lone Locust Productions. Join us on our new discussion forums at FusionPatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Username Fusion Patrol. You can also send us feedback by email at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. If you'd like to support Fusion Patrol, please leave us a review on iTunes. Fusion Patrol's theme music is Fight the Future by Amberwolf.